We've already seen innocent shoppers. A stick-up. It's the Joker. A clue? Yes, to Oriental royalty. Theft of the gold golf clubs. After them. But no, theft of the Maharaja. Did the van vanish or shrink? Traced to their lair, but not surprised. Wrapped for mailing. Into the mailbox. Addressed to oblivion. Is there no way out? No way but up? Let's all hold our breath for 1 minute. The gasser is yet to come.
Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires we call the interwebs is Joe Crazy Writer. How you doing tonight, Joe? Joe? Hello? Oh, that's right, Joe's not here. He is on vacation, wandering around in South Dakota. I don't know why you'd want to go there. You know, if I was going to go on a vacation, I'd go to a comic convention, or I'd go to New Orleans, or pretty much I'd go... Okay, let's be honest. I'd go anywhere but South Dakota, except maybe North Dakota. So, before he left on vacation, we recorded this episode. We recorded this episode extra long. It was an hour and 50 minutes of us talking about black and white comics, and we still didn't get to everything. So rather than put out a 2-hour episode last week, we're putting out two episodes from one conversation. We haven't done that before. So let me get y'all caught up on what we're talking about. We're talking about the history of black and white comics with an emphasis on the black and white boom and bust that happened in the mid-80s. We've got you up to the point where black and white comics have kind of taken over in the direct sales market. Now, Marvel and DC were still outselling these by far, but shops were pouring tons of money into black and white books because the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came out, and within a month, the first issue was worth $150. Critters had come out, and it was a little slower, but the first issue cost $1.50, and within like 6 months, it was $20. So we're all of these crappy, poorly drawn black and white books. Now, not all of them were crappy. Not all of them were poorly drawn. But I remember at the time, the Comic Buyer's Guide used to say, we don't review comics that are made by people pooling together their lunch money to print a comic. But you had big companies involved in this. You had Eclipse putting out Adolescent Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters. Marvel had one that eventually got printed as Power Pachyderms. I don't even remember what the title of it was. But here's how slow Marvel was about getting things done. They announced it in 85. It finally was put out as just a regular Marvel book aimed at kids called Power Pachyderms in like 89. And the only reason they printed it was, one, they'd already paid everybody, so they might as well get some money out of it. And second, they took the concept to a toy company when the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles toys came out. The other thing we talked about in the episode that you missed, and here's the cool thing, it's not like you missed it. You can go back and you can download it. You can go to crazycomics.com www.solitairerose.com, part of the Solitaire Rose family of websites, and you can download that episode, and you can listen to it before this one. But if you want to just go ahead and jump into this one, we talked about my time writing comics and how I did a ton of work and got paid absolutely nothing for it. Let's just say I'm not the brightest bulb on the tree when it comes to stuff like that. And we got to the point where there were, I think at one point there were like 40 or 50 of these black and white books coming out. There was Malibu, which had like six different imprints, but it's not the same Malibu that you know now. This was Malibu, and then they were putting out all these black and white books. And as we talk about the collapse, Malibu collapsed a person who worked for the Comics Journal and for the San Diego Con actually swooped in, bought it up, and completely changed the company. They were still putting out black and white books, but they were starting to edge more toward normal superhero stuff, so that by 1991-92, they were able to go to the boys at Image and say, you know what? You put together these books. You draw them and write them. We'll package them and do the distribution and everything. We'll take it cut off the top. I recently read an interview with Eric Larson. It wasn't really an interview. It was him and John Byrne sniping at each other on a message board. And he's still mad about that. He's still mad about how Malibu, they were all millionaires based on our sales, and they used their money to compete with us. Well, you know what? They got like 5% because they're the ones who did all the work. They found the publisher to actually print the books. They wrote up the stuff. They put it in the catalogs. They handled the orders. They did all of that. And everybody was making tons of money in the early 90s. Which is weird when you think about what was going on in the mid-80s. It was the same thing. People were making a lot of money. The books were not very good. And people were buying them because they were investment quality. Now, this here show, believe it or not, kids, has sponsors. Sponsor number one is DreamHost.com. DreamHost, the best damn web host in the whole known universe. If you go to DreamHost.com and you put in the code CRAZY, that's K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year of hosting. I have been with them since 1999. They have been nothing but wonderful for me. They host tons and tons and tons of websites. They may be one of the biggest web hosts in the known universe, but they're also the best web host in the known universe. Lifehacker, which is a website that reviews pretty much anything that has to do with the internet, gave them one of the five best web hosts that exist. So if you need yourself a website, go over to dreamhost.com, get yourself a website. We're also sponsored by Worldwide News at worldwidenews.solitairerose.com, part of the Solitaire Rose family of websites. It is a web strip about the lowest rated cable news network and the people who work there. It is written by me, your charming and delightful old uncle rap bastard, and it's drawn by dilapidated Dan Moore, who's having a little trouble with deadlines because it's convention season, and he's the guest of honor at a whole bunch of little bitty conventions, including one that's about webcomics. So go there, read the website, send an email to the artist and say, hey, get your ass drawing! Now, we also have an ad in here for Chris B. I got an email from Chris B. on Friday. She is putting together another tour. You know, a few months ago, she went on a tour where she threw everything in a van. No, not a van, down by the river. She threw everything in a van and took off for Washington, D.C., and had tons of adventures along the way, which you could go to her website, broomhildamusic.com, to see the video blogs about. But she wants to do it again, so she's trying to raise money. And the way to raise money for a musician is either A, get donations, but there's a better way. You could buy her CD for $12 off her website. She takes PayPal, and in the PayPal, you click the little PayPal button, you send her $12, and you tell her, I heard about this on Crazy Comics and Stories, and could you possibly autograph your CD? And I'm sure she will. She's a wonderful person. later on. I talk about some of the gigs she's got coming. It's a good thing to get on her mailing list because she has gigs that pop up out of nowhere. She has one today. Today is Sunday, July 10th, and she had one pop up at around 3:30 that she's playing in Chaska, Minnesota. I don't know where the hell that is, but she's playing in Chaska, Minnesota. So she has gigs that pop up out of nowhere. Sign up, and we give her music later in the show. And now, on with the show. What was happening in the larger comics world was that there were all these shops who were making their living off selling, you know, Marvel, DC, you know, indie books, but black and whites were where they were making the bank. And there were tons of shops opening up. I think I've talked about there was a shop in Galesburg, Illinois that, you know, when I left to come up to Minnesota to look for a job, I go in, oh, look, they've got racks and racks and racks of stuff. I come back a month and a half later, and it's gone.
Really?
Peoria had like four or five comic shops. By the end of the summer of 87, they were down to one. And that had happened in the larger realm as well. There were all these distributors. The biggest one, the biggest comic distributor at the time was one called Glenwood. And they were... The lines were very blurry. Most of the distributors also had shops. Why? Because the way the direct market had started, these shops were contacting Marvel, and Marvel would say, yep, we will set you up as a distributor if you order $3,000 worth of product a month. Same for DC. The smaller publishers would just jump on, send them, hey, you know, we're getting this stuff.
But I'm still a three-hour tour. The intrigue continues with the shipwreck.
So you had these distributors who also had shops, but they were also investing in these books. Let's say you're going to order, you as a shop are going to order 50 copies of Samurai Toaster Ovens and all these other shops. So orders come in and it's 10,000 copies of Samurai Toaster Ovens. Huh. Well, you know what? It's a black and white book. Sounds kind of silly. As a distributor, I'm going to order 15,000 copies because I have 10,000 that are ordered. And then 3 months from now, when it's sold out and it's selling for, you know, double or triple cover, I will offer it to shops at double or triple cover. And for a while, that was a huge money-making thing. At the beginning of the summer of 87, Glenwood was the number one comics distributor. They were having articles written about them as this great business, how they were making money hand over fist. By September, they were gone.
It just shows you, we're all just a tank of gas away from government cheese.
The biggest distributor of comics, gone. Now, Diamond Capital stayed around because they didn't play that game. But there were all these small distributors who all were doing the investing. And eventually, comic fans would, like they always do, like they did in the 90s, they'd bring the books back to the shop to sell. And the shop owner would go, well, you know what? I got 10 of them back here priced at 10 bucks. Nobody's buying them, so I'll give you a quarter each. Quarter each? But I bought these as an investment. Mm-hmm. F you, Mr. Comic Shop Dealer. So if they can't sell them for that much, they're certainly not going to buy them. And if they're not going to buy them, they're going to sit on the shelf. And when they sit on the shelf, the dealer doesn't make any money. And when the dealer doesn't make any money, eventually he closes.
Yeah.
And it happened that fast. The collapse was that fast. While I was researching this, I read about Mark Martin, who's an incredible cartoonist. He did one of my favorite black and white books from the time called Nat Rat. First issue of Nat Rat, he said he sold 100,000 copies. He was able to make a fortune, able to buy a house. Second issue did about 75,000 copies. Third issue, he printed up around 50,000 copies because that was the initial orders. Distributors went under between when it was ordered and when it was printed.
Dang.
And he lost everything.
For years on end, poor Marianne would have to stay in character, baking literally hundreds of coconut cream pies. I'm telling you, Corey, she'd have been your dream girl.
long as there's pie involved.
Just pretending to be fooled by that desperate play acting of six ruthless drug smugglers.
Now, there aren't statistics from back then as there are now because there were so many distributors we couldn't keep track. But what most people, like the Comic Buyer's Guide and Comics Journal, say is we went from around 12,000 comic shops to 4,000 between the beginning of 1987 and the end of 1987. Comic sales overall did a nosedive.
You know what's funny is they, I always love it when they blame, you know, stuff on comics, you know, comics, juvenile delinquents. I mean, think about it. Tarzan lives half naked. Cinderella comes home at midnight. Pinocchio lies all the time. Aladdin, King of Thieves. Batman drives 200 miles an hour. Sleeping Beauty, lazy. Snow White lives with seven guys. I don't know where I'm going with this.
Neither do I. I haven't known where you've been going all night.
I just read that North Korea is to chair the United Nations Disarmament Conference, and the irony almost made my head split in two. But anyways, continue.
So by 1988, comic sales were in the toilet. You know, Marvel and DC were doing okay. A lot of indies were in a lot of trouble. I remember Kitchen Sink at the time was cutting back a lot. Because, you know, they were publishing quality stuff. But comic stores said, I'm not ordering black and whites anymore. Shit don't sell. When I worked at Schinders, they would order Cerebus and ElfQuest and no other black and whites. And you would bring up a black and white book and they would go, black and whites, nope, we don't bother with them. They don't sell. So that boom and bust period from 84 to 87. Now, a lot of the books that were, they'll be in quarter bins. Actually, you got to remember, that's over 25 years ago. A lot of that stuff, people threw away. How many shops had racks of that stuff that they just pitched?
Overstreet at one time say he wasn't going to list these books?
Most of them, they do not.
Yeah. I mean, that's why one of my favorite guides is the Comic Buyer's Guide, Big Book. You know, whether you're getting just the checklist from Modern Age or the big one, they got that list of everything because they do list them all. It's almost an invaluable resource because, like, if we want to go up and look, well, just how many Fish Police series were there? Because I remember Fish Police went one to something and then was picked up by Apple Comics, which itself was, I believe, an offshoot from
ElfQuest.
No, was it Cerebus?
Nope. That was Aardvark Vanaheim.
That's right.
AV Comics.
So, you know, again, they went into different things. They went color. The only reason I keep mentioning Fish Police is eventually it became a really, really bad animated series back about the time the Simpson boom was going on. But that's jumping forward, I believe,
yep,
into 92 or 93.
So let's jump to 1989. So you've got comic shops have collapsed. You've only got like 4,000, supposedly. You only have two distributors. You had a couple very minor distributors. Rip Off Press was still distributing. You had others that were, you know, small specialty, but it was basically Cap City and Diamond. And the Batman boom hit. And I worked at Schinders when Batman hit. And, well, first off, it didn't matter. If Batman was on it, it sold out. It didn't matter how many we got. We would get, like, once a month, we would get between 20 and 25 Dark Knight Returns, the paperback, and they'd be gone within 3 days.
This was after Dark Knight?
It was after Dark Knight. Yeah. It was around the time of the death of Robin.
Yeah, that's like I talked about earlier. I sold my entire Batman run, and I mean, I was collecting it probably, I don't know. It was back when Detective Batman linked together, and Batman was semi-sane. It was actually, I think they introduced the second Robin before they decided to make him a spoiled brat that they eventually killed off with a 900 number. And I mean, I literally, the year before Dark Knight hit, I just blew him out at a quarter a piece to somebody. And then the following year, $5, $10 a piece. Boy, by the time the Batman movie hit, Joker appearances were going through the roof. I mean, it was nuts. Kind of fun, though.
Yep. So you had basically the same thing start to rev up again. And in a lot of ways, what happened in the 90s showed that we didn't learn any lesson in the 80s. You had all these people who, oh, look, these Valiant books are worth a lot of money. These Image books are worth a lot of money. And a year or so later, you'd bring them in to sell them at the shop, and the shop would go, but I still got 100 of them on the shelf. I don't need them. Well, if they're not worth any money, I'm not fucking buying these. I don't think that's what's happening now. I think what's happening now, there are two things happening now, and that is the audience is aging out of comics. And the other thing is, if you look at like at 1998, 99 sales figures, they're around the same, except when you get to the lower end, because I would track sales back then. I actually had them on my website. And by the time you get to like the book that's selling, you know, the number 200 book, it's selling less than 1,000. You get to the number 300 book, and I remember it would sell like 400, 500, 600. Now you get down to the number 300 book, it's selling 3,000 to 4,000 copies. So I also think that comic sales have spread out among a number of books. You don't have books that sell 130,000 copies. You've got six books that sell 35,000 copies. But what happened with black and whites, Joe?
I think they eventually became a landfill.
By the time you started your store, we're going to go into how you would order a black and white, which means this is a tale from the shop.
Yes.
Tales from the Shop is sponsored by Chris B. at BroomhildaMusic.com. Let me go to her website right now. I talked to her a couple of days ago, and she said she wanted me to push the CD. I have the CD. It's wonderful, and you can order it at her website.
And BroomhildaMusic.com.
BroomhildaMusic.com. You just go to the you click on her picture, it takes you right to the front page, and on the front page, her debut album, It Was You. It's available on iTunes, so you can order it there. Or you can just buy the CD directly from her for $12. Or you could go to one of her gigs and buy the CD for $10. I don't think she has a lot of gigs coming up. Her next gig is Tuesday, August 12th at Michigan's Women's Music Festival in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She also has something coming up at the Farm Folk Alliance in Bolingbrook, Illinois in September. She doesn't have a lot of gigs this summer that are announced yet, but she was the kickoff performer at the Pride Festival down in Minneapolis. So go and buy her CD. And when you do, tell her it's because you heard this ad. Tales from the Shop, sponsored by Broomhilda Music, Crispy. Great stuff. Go listen. So, Joe, you started your shop in 92.
Correct.
Did you order a lot of black and white books? And when you did, what was the criteria for ordering them?
The books, when I would order a book, it wasn't necessarily, was it black and white, was it color? That really didn't come into play. What came into play was, did anybody want to buy it? We had one big advantage. I already bought... My partner and I, we bought an existing shop, and one of the reasons we bought it, and I may believe I've waxed poetic about it, is that we looked at what they were doing versus what we could be doing. One of our old buddies, Butch, you know, he used to talk about how the owner of Hot Comics at the time didn't order Iron Man. Why? Didn't like it. So Butch would have to run down the street to Schindler's to buy his Iron Man, even though he would have preferred to buy it from his friend at the store. Well, Pat and I didn't really operate that way. We operated off the idea if somebody wants to buy it, they will. And back then, when we first started, we bought through Capital City. because, and funny enough, I actually found an old box from Capital City in my garage. And you had to buy three of anything. That was your minimum order of anything. And we decided, I think we got stuck very rarely, because I came off the philosophy that I could sell pretty much three of anything. And so if one person ordered it, I'd order it, put the two on the shelf. If I had two to sell, if I had whatever. If anybody ordered 10 of anything, I would order extras for the shelf. Sometimes we were tipped off on books that totally escaped my preview radar, just like I ranted about in the beginning of the podcast. You know, so many comics out there. How are you going to know which one anybody's going to care about? That's how I discovered She. Not Black and White, but all of a sudden, 15 people ordered She, which was phenomenal, out of 300 people, and maybe about 50 to 60 were just there for the whole Death of Superman thing. But all of a sudden, you had 15 people ordering She. So I took a chance. I figured I ordered 15 people. I ordered 15 extra copies. And She number one was, again, one of those comics that went up because it got real hot, came down. So it's not just an exclusive thing. It's not a Valiant thing. It repeats itself over and over. Comic go up, comic come down. All those people now that bought all those rare black and white variants of Superman, Jim Lee cover, it went up, it come down. You know, even now you could buy variants for cover price on eBay. I mean, plus shipping, rather than pay 10 bucks at a store. I mean, it's the same thing over and over. So anyways, the first one we'd order, I mean, obviously we talked about Cerebus. I read Cerebus. I think you read Cerebus when you joined.
Yep, but I bought it in book form.
Okay, and we had about 12 to 13 people that bought Cerebus. Eventually that number kind of whittled down to about 7. So I would always order one or two for the shelf. Sometimes they would sell. Sometimes they wouldn't sell. I forget the company. Was it AC? Somebody did reprints of Western comics. It was always in the beginning of previews. They were usually about $4 or $5 a pop. I would order just one of each, put it on the shelf. Some were in color. Most were black and white reprints. Every 3-4 months, somebody would come in and buy them all. Never met who was doing it, because obviously they do it on a day I wasn't there. I would watch things in the mail if they sent me flyers. One of the cooler things we would get every week, you get this envelope or plastic baggie full of samples, flyers, you know, just things saying, hey, here I am, try me. I would look closely at that, and I would try to figure out. Sometimes I'd order just, well, when Cap dropped their minimum, and I think they did that in response to Diamond Comics, because Diamond suddenly said, guess what, you only have to order one. And then Cap kind of went, all right, you only have to order one. So it made it a lot easier, and I've ranted before about that. If somebody came up to me and said, I want this, even if it wasn't anything I've never thought I'd sell in my life, I would order it for them. And because I figured if you're willing to order it, and I didn't take pre-orders. So anyways, you know, there was another way. You know, get this big pile of flyers and samples. One of my favorite stories, and excuse me here while I Google some stuff because I want to get the guy's name right. Remember the comic book I got in called Brewhead? Do you remember that one, Corey?
Yes.
Artist Mike Pascal sent me a copy of Brewhead, just out of the blue, and I read it, and it was funny. And it was a black and white comic, and so I basically emailed him back. All right, what am I talking about? There was no email. I just sent in an order, said send me 10 copies. And I ended up, direct from him, sold 10 copies. And I actually got to meet him finally at one of the Comic Cons, shows, whatever. And so that worked. I mean, he direct mailed me out of the blue. And I was able to, able to do it that way. Sometimes I would meet black and white people at Cap City, had their retailer show. And Corey and I, we're going to have to get together and really talk about this because they all blur together to me. But I do remember going there, and that's where I met the Poison Elves creator who passed away, Drew Haynes.
Yep, Drew Haynes.
And you meet him, and sometimes you just say, yeah, I'll buy your stuff. I'll give it a try. I think Tug and Buster was another book that I picked up that way that eventually went to Image for a few issues when Valentino started his line. Normal Man. I mean, one of these days I'll just go through my collection, all these black and white. Some of them I still have. Like there was one book called Adventures in Mistwood. Beautiful cover. Inside art, so-so. One issue, never saw it again. But I still have it just because the cover is really cool. There was a couple called Pure Silly, where it was just a cover of Kirk holding Spock aghast, and Spock's got this big hole burning in him, and Jim, you see Bones over him going, he's dead, Jim, really, this time. I mean it, he is. And behind his back, he's holding a phaser. You know, just silly covers like that. And so I was very open to wherever these would come from, either the previews catalog by people wanting to order it or asking me about it, the flyers that would be sent to me, direct mail, meeting them face to face. I used to love to go to the comic cons too, because I'd walk in and I'd talk to people and they would, I would say, well, let me order 5-10 copies direct from you. And they do a wholesale deal right on the spot, and I put them on the shelf. And, you know, sometimes they'd come back and or people would come in and say, here's all the people I met and their comics. And almost the entire time I had Hot Comics, up until maybe towards the end, I was convinced I could order 2 to 3 copies of almost anything. Somebody would try it. And I think, you know, it's, again, now we're going on into the 90s, where eventually I would find, I think cold cut distribution would work exclusively with small press publishers, and they didn't have the minimum orders either. They had a minimum dollar amount you had to order, but you didn't have to, you know, I could spot order that. So new copies of, say, A Distant Soil, Colleen Doran's book, would come out. I'd get it from Diamond. And then if I wanted back issues, since Diamond never really left stuff in stock, I could order from Cold Cut and get it from them. Dave Sim, again, the Cerebus guy, he started to get a program together going. Because what happened was with Dave is everybody kind of looked at him as if he was the king of self-publishers, which really annoyed him because he wasn't, his attitude would be, I am not the king of self-publishers. You are your own king of self-publishing, because everybody wanted to emulate what he was doing. By then, he was doing the phone books, like you talked about, the big books. And but he came up with an idea, and it kind of caught on for a while and eventually disappeared, where it's 40 for 5. Any retailer call you and give them 40% off, which was a better discount than you were getting from Diamond or Capital. And you'd be able to buy direct from people. I see that was also something, too, that limited black and whites. Because as a retailer, depending on what I ordered would depend on the discount I get. It wasn't necessarily I get a better discount for the more I order, which was true. Sometimes it would be, okay, I'll take up a title. Let's see. PETA's Vegetarian College Cookbook. Oh, sorry, I don't know why that's in my comic pile. Did I tell you my daughter turned 18?
Oh. And
we'll talk about that later. Anyways, say it's PETA's Vegetarian Meat Cookbook, whatever, versus Spider-Man. Okay? Right away, I get a 50% discount off cover price for ordering Spider-Man, whether I order 1 or 100. On the vegan cookbook, the discount was only 35%. Now, most comic stores would give you at least a 10% discount just for coming in. So money-wise, there wasn't a lot of reason for me to carry the vegan cookbook because I'm going to be making less money on it than Spider-Man, who's been around for, at that time, 30 years. And this debate raged quite some time about why is it that I get less of a discount on black and whites and small press than I do on the majors. Eventually, it came around where now, and again, I haven't ordered new comics since 06, but now I get the same discount from Marvel, DC, whoever, and I can get that same discount on the small press stuff. So in other words, I'll make the same copy selling one copy of Vegan College Cookbook as I will Amazing Spider-Man. But again, in the 90s, there was a big disincentive to order these books. And that's where places like even Cold Cut would jump in because they'd say, hey, we're giving you half 50% discount anyways. If you order more, we'll give you more. So they tried to keep drumming up business that way. And again, I don't think other than retailers, a lot of people realize that there just wasn't a big reason for a retailer to risk on a book. You know, remember, retailers buy things they don't return. They don't get to return things. In other words, they're the actual customer. Whether you, as a consumer, buy the vegan cookbook or not, I bought it. It's mine. It stays in my inventory forever until I quarter box it, burn it, or just, you know, put it up on eBay for 50 cents. Any questions?
Nope.
I kind of ran through a different, all sorts of different concepts there, but I mean, there were just a lot of different things in it. You know, it was, I sound kind of complaining, but it was fun. I mean, I genuinely loved finding, you know, like when Mike sent me a copy of Brewhead and it ended up being sales, I think I must have sold more than he thought. I was probably one of the better discount or better sellers of Brewhead because, you know, we had fun with it. We ordered it through Capital, through Diamond. There are other permutations on this, and I don't know where we are, but we can probably follow this up later. But, you know, back then, when everything started going exclusive, and when did that happen, Corey, when Heroes World jumped in? And
95.
Okay, so we're in the mid-90s when Marvel bought Heroes World, and all Marvels had to go through Heroes World. And I believe, if I'm remembering right, your basic discount through Heroes World started again at like 35 or 40%. So if you were a small guy, small comic shop, you just lost a big chunk of your profits. Whereas before you used to get 50, now you're back at that. But it's Marvel. You got to order it. And Heroes World was always trying to pump you up to about, well, you know, if you buy 20 copies, we'll give you an extra discount. And then they started flashing these exclusive hardcover books, which you'll see on eBay every so often. Complete X-Men, complete Spider-Man. You know, usually they had a nice flashy cover with a red X or a spider symbol. And they in and of themselves are quite collectible, but you had to order them. If you ordered, say, 100 copies of Amazing X-Men that you didn't want to order, but you wanted the hardcover. Or they'd come up with X-Men Gold. 300 copies, free neon sign, you know. So they were doing that. But meanwhile, what happened was is everybody picked sides, and most everybody picked Diamond, which left Capital City with a handful of exclusives and all the black and whites you could eat and small press. And I'm not going to get any more on that because I got to stop and think about how that changed things. But one thing you'll notice is as we talked about black and white comics and we got into how I order things, I didn't really look at it as black and white or not. I looked at it small press. So to me, whether it was color small press or black and white small press, it was the same thing to me. And, you know, again, if I could sell it, if you wanted to buy it, that was the bottom line.
All right, taking a break here in the middle of the program to give you a little more information on what was happening in the 90s. and what was happening with self-publishing. A lot of black and white comics were being self-published. We talked about Cerebus. We talked about ElfQuest. There was also A Distant Soil. There was, there was Bone. There was Hepcats. There were all these self-publishers that were doing black and white books in the early 90s. Now, the black and whites still didn't sell very well because there was still that stink from the 80s on them. But Dave Sim and a bunch of other artists like Steve Bissett and Colleen Duran, they decided, you know what? There's all this money sloshing around. The Image guys are self-publishing, although I'll be honest, I never saw Image as self-publishing because the six original creators, actually there were seven, but they've since rewritten history to write out Wolf's Portacio. They all were able to keep the rights to their books. But let's say that Rob Liefeld creates a book. He has his friend write it. He hires somebody to draw it. Everything's still owned by him. And I remember at the time, the stories were owned by him. The art was owned by him. He would give the artist the art back unless he had something to do with it, like if he provided layouts or he had something to do with inking or anything like that. But there were also allegations that some of the creators who would have people work on their stuff would actually sell the art as their own, even though they had other people doing a lot of work on it. They wouldn't give the inkers any of the art, etc., etc. But that's a different story. So you had a lot of the self-publishing people because it was easy and there was money sloshing around in comics. Steve Bissett has talked about how when he started Tyrant, he took first issue sold great, and it was the second issue sold kind of okay, and the third issue didn't sell well, and the fourth issue sold in the toilet, and he pretty much had to quit comics and work at a video store through a lot of the 90s because stuff just wasn't selling anymore. So a lot of the self-publishers, when they started in the early 90s, it really felt like a revolution. It really felt like artists were going to be able to own their own stuff. And Marvel, who had a creator-owned imprint called Epic, after Archie Goodwin left, Epic stayed around, but it pretty much faded off and died during this time. DC, they didn't really have a creator-owned imprint until Vertigo. And Vertigo wasn't all creator-owned. It was partially creator-owned, but if you worked on a character that DC had already owned, like Sandman, or Black Orchid, or Swamp Thing, or Animal Man, DC still owned it. So there was this feeling that there was finally going to be a revolution in creators owning their own stuff. Then the comic market collapsed, and a lot of self-publishers, they didn't have the deep pockets of Marvel and DC. Marvel went into bankruptcy, and we could go on and on and on about how it was a lot of financial mismanagement and how there was stock issues. But there was a lot of it also where Marvel pretty much killed the goose that laid the golden egg. They said, you know what? We want all the money. We're not just going to flood the market. We're also going to buy a distributor and we're going to distribute the books ourselves. Trying to get that 5-6% that Diamond or Cap City or any of the other distributors would get. And in a lot of ways, that's what caused the huge collapse. Sales were already trending down, but the good shops were doing okay. However, when it got to the point where they had to order from three distributors, and that means you're paying three times as much in shipping for your books. Different distributors had different price points. You would get 50% from this distributor and 60 from this one and 54 from this one. And instead of just sending one check, you had to send three. That really hurt a lot of shops. So you didn't just have sales dropping. You also had the distribution network completely collapse. Much like in the 50s. We could talk all we want about the Comics Code, but what killed comics in the 50s was a distribution collapse. The publishers couldn't get the books to the stores. Now, when you got comic shops, when the main thing they sell is comics, if it's hard to get the books to the stores, the shops die. And that's what happened. Much like in the 80s, you had, I think it was, they estimated 10,000 comic shops in 1992, or 10,000 places that sold comics. And by 1996, it was down to 3,000. And we've pretty much stayed at between 2,500 and 3,000 shops since then. So a lot of what happened in the 90s was just a reflection on a bigger scale of what happened in the 80s. The problem is the collapse in the 90s, you had all of these self-publishers who were doing black and white books. Now, some of them went to Image. Image shifted from like 94, 95 to publishing other creators' stuff and really changing how they did business. And the reason for that wasn't because, well, we're now going to be a bastion of individuality and creator-owned stuff. No. When they went to Diamond, they had to have a certain percentage of books in order to remain a premier publisher. They had to have a market share above 5%. And the books that they were trying to sell, all the imagey type stuff in the early 90s, it wasn't selling. It wasn't making money. So they brought in a lot of independent folk. They brought in a lot of established books like Bone and A Distant Soil by Colleen Duran to keep at that 5% level so they could remain premier publishers. Now, Joe and I talk a lot more about what he did in his shop, but I just wanted to give a little more information on what happened in the 90s. So back to the show. We're going to jump ahead to now.
Dun, dun, dun.
Because we're pretty much at 90 minutes.
Yep.
By now, black and white, it's really weird how there are still some fans who will say, I don't read black and white. No. My favorite books are the Essential and Showcase books from Marvel and DC, where they reprint 25 to 30 issues, big cheap format on cheap paper, black and white.
And, you know, you're, I mean, granted, the $50, the $100 Omnibus Masterworks Archive Editions are awesome. But some, I just want to read these stories, and I read them cheap.
Yeah, like you each, can't.
Yeah, they're good reading. Sometimes, like what we talked, I think we talked about it way, 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 way long ago. Like when I was reading the Phantom Stranger Showcase, oh, my stars and garters. I couldn't get through the first 15 issues because it was the same formula every issue.
Well, the reason I liked the Essentials, we could go into that forever.
Oh, yeah.
But one of the things I really like about them is they're kind of disposable.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel's been very good about keeping them in print.
Except for two.
Well, Conan, they lost the rights to. And what's the other one, Joe?
Godzilla.
Godzilla, you can actually still order from Diamond.
Okay, and they allowed that as a one-time printing, unless they are continually printing them.
Nope, they're not continuously printing. Marvel double-printed. Basically, they took the number that people ordered, doubled it, and that's what they printed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some that are out of print. I think the Tomb of Draculas are out of print. The Frankenstein Monsters out of print.
The horror ones.
But the cool thing about them is, you know, they're big, thick, cheap. What I would do, and I don't do it anymore because I have an MP3 player, but what I used to do, I would take them to the gym. And if I'm going to be on the exercise bike, boom, there I go. I'm going to be reading that thing at the gym because I'm on that exercise bike for a half hour, 45 minutes,
That's
hour,
funny because my old partner, Pat, he has an exercise bike at home, but he likes to read. That's how he reads the Omnibus.
Yep.
He's always worried he'll drop it, but he's propped it up so he can flip through them, and that's almost perfect.
Well, and he's at home, mm-hmm. so he could probably buy a rack and everything. And I'm at the gym. I'm basically putting it there. I might drop it. I might sweat on it, all this other stuff. But the biggest selling independent book, what is Image's best-selling book, Joe?
Walking Dead.
And it's black and white, and it always has been.
And I am caught up with it. The week after, last time you taunted me, they came out with the volume 14, which brought me up to issue 84. And I bought issue 85, and I believe 86 came out this week. So I'm caught up.
And remember what I told you?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's safe.
Nope.
No one is safe.
We're forced to conclude that the brilliant, cunning criminal genius amongst them was, yes, Gilligan himself.
Okay. So by now, there are still fans. I see them on the comic forum. I've met them. They still, you say black and white, they won't read it. Doesn't matter. They just won't read it. I don't think you're ever going to see another huge boom and bust cycle again. I think the market is way too small for that.
And
but,
it's weird. Like I was ranting at the beginning of the podcast. I just, being gone for 5 months, I barely recognize what Marvel and DC are trying to push on me. And what's worse, I don't care. And again, I may change my mind once I get the current previews. That's going to cover the, say, 52 initially. And they're talking about even more comics coming down the pike.
Well, and I think the other thing to remember is, especially for fans like you and me, comics are a habitual thing.
Mm-hmm.
We get them every week. We get them every 2 weeks. Yeah, we go to the shop. It's part of it's like a fan club type mentality. And when you get out of that, you know, how many people at your shop would say, okay, I need to drop my subscription? And they would come, you know, they might come by the shop and pick up a thing here and there, but they never came back.
Yeah.
Because
or how many people disappeared when, you know, a comic store closed or I left or Christie's went under and they just, whatever. I mean, I could have seen very, very easily when I was, you know, gone for 5 months and I didn't have comics to go with that, I could have dropped it real easy. Oh, but then those graphic novels came and what did I read? 8 of them in like 1 week?
Well, the other thing to remember about that, Nick at The Source actually commissioned a study. A little more than half of people, when a comic shop closes, they just quit reading comics. A little more than half.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had comic shops closing the past couple of years, so you've got that going on. Do I ever think that there's going to be another resurgence of black and white books? I just think it'll be, you know, there are some books that are black and white. Most books are going to be in color. Although the weird thing is, every so often, you'll see these companies try to revive some of this stuff. IDW is going to try another Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles series, even though the last, pretty much since the cartoon, it has not sold well. There are people who are Turtles fans, but they won't buy the comic. And it's weird that you can put out a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, even a crappy one, and it'll pull $100 million and it'll sell. And there are still people watching the cartoon and the toys, but the comic can barely sell 10,000 copies with the original creators working on it. What was the one that, they tried Adolescent Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody actually bought the rights to that. And I think maybe one issue came out.
Yeah.
Maybe. Not sure. Don't know. It's one of the problems I see with this stuff that people go, oh, it's old and it sold a whole lot of copies back then. They forget that people weren't buying it to read it. There is no one.
Yeah.
No one who has a deep, abiding love for Miami Mice. There is no one sitting at home going, you know, I wish they would do more issues of geriatric gangrene jujitsu hamsters. Although there is one book from back then that I would love to see again. And this is how we're going to close the show. You know what my favorite of the black and white boom books was, Joe? Other
Omaha.
Than Nat Rat.
Omaha.
Nat Rat was amazing.
Oh, Nat Rat was fun.
Matter of fact, I'm going to recommend to anybody listening to this, if you can go out and find the complete Nat Rat, you will see that the first issue, it's really standard parody. And by the last issue, it's this wonderfully surreal, strange book. Mark Martin did 20 Nude Dancers 20 in the Comic Buyer's Guide. He's a wonderful, wonderful cartoonist who has moved into animation because, he went bankrupt publishing comics. But the complete Nat Rat was just so great. I don't count Omaha as part of the boom bust because it came from the undergrounds.
True.
But the one I miss that is so obscure. Do you have that book, that Comic Buyer's Guide book with you, Joe?
Give me a pause. Let me go get it.
Okay. It's a book called Death Crazed Teenage Superheroes.
I don't even know that one.
I think it lasted three issues, maybe two. There was another problem, and one of the things you'll see in that big CBG book is there are some books where they don't know how many issues they published. They'll have like, you know, we know there was two, and there might have been four. There'll be a question mark or some sort of thing where, yeah, they just did. They don't know.
And they're willing, if you actually have a comic of it. Oh, hang on a second. According to Google, they have two issues recorded. Issue one, yeah, they have two issues. Nobody's written a volume. This is Comic Vine that popped up after a Google search, and they have two issues listed. Was there a third?
Don't know.
Don't know.
Now, the thing is, here's the fun thing. You could go to Amazon and buy it.
That's funny. I'm looking like at my comic shop and... Actually, you know what? I just remembered something. Let me, there's a place, AtomicAvenue.com. This is put on, they're tied into the Comic Base. If you've ever, seen that software program, it's a wonderful program you can use to, keep your comics in order. And you can also do things like when cons come around, give me a list of all the things I'm missing. From Comic Base, you can sell comics on AtomicAvenue.com. It's something I used to do. I don't anymore because you never know when the heck I'm going to be here or not. But this all ties in because the CBG helps these guys put together all their comic books. So I'm just going to put in Death Craze. Here it is, Death Craze Teenage Superheroes. And... you may have to edit some. Here we go. They, too, only show two issues.
Yep.
And you can buy – they have five copies of number one available for 49 cents and seven copies available for 59 cents. So if you want it, come get some.
Now, when I read it, it was a weird book. It was kind of – okay, these teenagers become superheroes and they're not quite balanced. Well, one of them was the one on the cover who kind of looks like Wolverine with a gun, mm-hmm. was pretty much the death crazed one who couldn't wait to kill villains. And the other two were restraining him, et cetera, et cetera. But it was one of the black and white books that had, you know, the four, you had to have a four word title, but it was kind of a precursor to all of the more violent books of the '90s. And because it was, there weren't other books like it, I enjoyed it. I just remember really liking it. I have not read it since it came out. And I don't want to go to the storage place and try and dig through all the boxes to try and find it. So I may just buy these for, well, what? I could get them for a little over a buck to see if they were as good as I remember. But it was... For those of you listening, I'll wrap up my thought. Death Craze Teenage Superheroes, I may just order that to see if it's as good as I remember or if my memory is faulty. But I remember really enjoying it because it was a breath of fresh air. It was really different at the time. Now, the guy who wrote it, Jim Erskine, if you go to his Amazon page, he writes a lot of humor books. And he's written a book on homeschooling.
You got to love a guy who's had a company called Arf Arf.
Let's see. He's got How to Fold a Banana or 146 Other Things to Do When You're Bored. How to Throw a Tomato and Other 151 Ways to Be Mean and Nasty. a Southerner's instruction book. He's got a poetry book called To Clear My Head. Southerner's Book of Lists, which I believe I've actually seen at some point. Our Worst Homeschool Mistakes and How You Can Avoid Them. Easy Homeschooling. How to Get Your Kids to Get Things Done. Our Favorite Homeschool Activities Ever. So the funny thing is, I know a lot of people who homeschool are also religious. I wonder what they think when they're going to his Amazon page. I wonder what else he's got here. How to Tame This Homeschool Information. How to Hug a Teddy. All New Cookbook for Diabetics and Their Families. Death Craze Teenage Superheroes. So, we are cutting this episode in two, so you're going to get an episode this week, and the second part next week. Don't know where I'm going to be cutting it, but I'm going to be cutting it. So, Joe, there'll be some parts that you don't get to hear until you listen to the episode.
Yep.
But you don't listen to the episodes, do you?
And as we know, any visitor who couldn't be bribed into silence by Howell would be subtly maneuvered into situations where he would prefer to leave the castaways alone.
Speaking of leaving people alone, we're going to leave you alone now.
And I'm going to go find my rescue with Gilligan Island. I bought it for a buck at Walmart once. I got to see how that jives up.
So you've been listening to us blather on about black and white comic books for two whole weeks. And we would like to remind you, as we always do, that the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic you like the most.
Whether it's black or white.